Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. For readers of true crime sagas like Tinseltown and Little Demon in the City of Light, comes a chilling account of a murder that captivated the United States in the 1920s. 12-year-old Marion Parker was kidnapped from her Los Angeles school by an unknown assailant on December 15, 1927. Her body appeared days later, delivered to her father by the killer, who fled with the ransom money. When William Hickman was hunted down and charged with the killing, he admitted to all of it in terrifying detail. But that was only the start. Hickman's insanity plea was the first of its kind in the history of California, and the nature of the crime led to a media frenzy unlike any the country had ever seen. His lawyers argued that their client lived in a fantasy world, inspired by movies and unable to tell right from wrong. The movie industry scrambled to protect its exploding popularity and profits from ruinous publicity. Outside the courtroom, the country craved every awful detail, and the media happily fed that hunger. As scandals threatened the proceedings from the start, the death of a young girl grew into a referendum on the state of America at the birth of mass media culture. David Wilson, a private investigator for over 30 years, captures the maelstrom of Marion Parker's death in vivid detail. From the crime itself to the manhunt that followed, from the unprecedented trial to its aftermath, Wilson draws readers into the birth of the celebrity criminal. The book that we're featuring this evening is Not Just Evil, with my special guest, journalist and author, David Wilson. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, David Wilson.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really enjoy the opportunity to talk about the book, and talk about a little bit too about the implications of the case, which I leave up to the reader. But for me, there's some personal opinions about the significance of the case and why it's important to kind of take a look at it in retrospect and see how it's influenced everything from that point on.
Tell our audience how you came to be the writer of this book. Tell us what made you be in a position to want to do this book and that this was important to you.
Yes, that's a good question. The case was originally brought to my attention by my brother, who was a film major at USC. He actually went to school there at the same time as Ron Howard, and he fancied himself as a bit of a film historian, and he ran into this story back then, and we got to talking about it, and he gathered some of the documents to support it, and I had written some other books, and he asked me if I'd be interested in it. And to be honest with you, I jumped at it because it was really a compelling story. He had done a fair share of the research and convinced me that it was an important milestone in the history of the justice system in America.
Yeah, it certainly is. Now, let's get to the time, because you do provide this incredible, again, vivid picture of and portrayal of what the time was like. And again, in 1927, we think many things are different, but so many things are very, very similar, oddly enough. So let's talk about where Perry Parker and Geraldine Parker and Marion Parker lived, sort of an affluent little community here in around Los Angeles. So tell us about this little community they lived in, what it was really like and what it was considered, and just a little bit about the Parker family and
sure.
what Mr. Parker did. He worked at, so go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, interestingly enough, I grew up fairly close to that same area. And in the late 20s, I think Los Angeles was still a bit more rural than we might imagine. There were still farms and ranches in the city, which are now long gone, obviously. And there was kind of the seeds of what I would call a community catering towards a workforce. So they were starting the concept of tract homes and bedroom communities. But the particular neighborhood where this happened was probably an upscale, upper-middle-class neighborhood that was probably unique at the time because it was built at the time of the story where most of the upper middle class neighborhoods throughout the rest of the country were older and tended to be more brownstone and more stable. This was a newer community built for specifically a targeted audience. So it was kind of sold on the idea that it was safe and that it was people of similar background, and it was kind of the American dream at the time in some ways.
Now, Mr. Parker worked at the First National Bank.
He did, excuse me, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, he worked at the bank. He was also well known, too, because part of the interest in the story is that a lot of the players and characters and figures who had a role in the case actually knew him personally. So he was a well-known banker. He was respected, took his job seriously. There was no hint of any bad behavior on his part or in terms of the way he conducted himself as a banker. And he seemed to be well-liked. I mean, everybody who encountered him during the investigation and trial who had known him before had nothing but positive things to say about him.
Yes, we'll talk about those, again, bizarre, almost strange connections with the next-door neighbor being, so we'll talk about that at that time. So now let's go to December 15th. They're in this community. They're affluent. They're in the safest part of this community. It is a safe time, relatively, because of the crime that we're going to describe was unprecedented at that time. It shocked the entire nation, if not a lot of the world. So
yes.
December 15th, 1927, and Mr. Parker gets a call from Naomi Britton, which is the school secretary.
Right.
And she calls to ask if the family would want to have Marion's twin sister, the 12-year-old Marion that we mentioned in the beginning, her twin sister to come home as well, and then tell us what Mr. Parker deduces from speaking to Naomi Britton in short order. And
yes, to give it a little of context, the school was calling because someone had come by the school to pick up Marion Parker to take her to the hospital because supposedly her father was in an automobile accident, and it was her father who picked up the phone, and he obviously was not at the hospital. He had not been in an accident, and he had not authorized anybody to go to the school to pick him up his daughter, and so he was immediately concerned, stressed, realized something was wrong, the school realized that they had made a significant blunder. I'd have to say, nowadays, the chances of a stranger taking a kid out of school is probably non-existent. And at the time, it was a little more, it was more likely around that time, but even then they had the rules and restrictions on who could take a student out of the school. And for some of those rules were not really followed closely. The principal who should have authorized the release was not available, and the secretary kind of made a decision based on her belief in the credibility of the story. And so she went with William Hickman, who had come and claimed to be George Fox. I think that was the alias he used at the time. And said that he was going to take Marion to the hospital because their father had requested. And I think perhaps it's not clear if he knew she had a twin sister or not, but he certainly only asked for the one daughter.
To be fair to the secretary, because then this is part of it, because it came quite controversial shortly
right.
after, or immediately after,
yes.
is that this guy had the fantastic ruse. He was well-dressed.
Right.
He had this alias, but he also had, he had offered to say, oh, I work with, he knew enough where Mr. Parker works, so he said, I work at the
right.
First National Bank with Mr. Parker.
Right.
If you would like to call them and verify my identity. So he was good enough to bluff, and nobody took him up on that. So to be fair, that's an unusual rule.
No, yes.
That might even work today.
That's a good, yeah, it's a good point. And he knew some of the details because, in fact, he had worked for Parker several years earlier and knew the routine, knew where he worked, knew personal details about the man's life. So it was not like he was making up a story. He had some information to work with, which made him even more convincing, I think.
Now let's get to this phone call that he gets about, and he deduces what happens with his daughter in that she's been kidnapped by this man, and so they're scrambling to find out. He contacts police, obviously. Tell us what happens next and what he does, and what is the police reaction? It's interesting you say that they immediately, of course, think he may be a suspect. So tell us how police proceed with this kidnapping. As far as they know.
Well, the kidnapper obviously told Parker not to contact the police. That's kind of a common thing in kidnapping cases. It rarely happens that way, but that's certainly a common request. And the police had the drop-off spot under surveillance for the first meeting, and apparently Hickman saw them, noticed them, felt something was wrong, and didn't follow up with the exchange, which made the father really upset. And as he got more and more upset about that, the police became more and more suspicious of him, and the whole thing got off to kind of a shaky start, let's say.
Now, there's ways of he's communicating. There's the phone call. They put a tap on the phone,
right.
But he's also using telegraphs, and then he's also then sending packages. So
right.
The second one, he talks about using this common theme. He uses use good judgment, interference, dangerous, and this
right.
progresses as time goes on because there's just more than the two communications.
Now. Right.
Now, he tells them, don't have the police involved. So what does Mr. Parker do? What does he ask the police to do? And what do the police do in response to his request?
Well, he insisted on the second drop-off that he go alone and that he be allowed to make the exchange without them watching him so that he didn't run the risk of a second failure at the exchange and the police agreed to his terms at that point.
Now, the terms are $1,500 U.S., $75, $20 gold certificates. That's just one of the stipulations, right?
Right, yes. Go ahead.
And he always talks about this death, close to death, Mr. Parker, and trust, and so he says, and it's always if you interfere, so
right. You know, from from a psychological point of view, I think he was laying the foundation to deflect his own guilt and blame, and to it becomes clear as the case unfolds, which is clear in many cases. I did a lot of work doing criminal defense work, and criminals who commit especially serious crimes have a tendency to scapegoat others, blame others, do everything except take responsibility for their own involvement. So it's it seems to me in his behavior he was kind of at least unconsciously laying that foundation.
Now, with the first communication, he realizes that the police have been notified, so he's angry. He says so. He indicates that in the correspondence. But what he gets in the correspondence as well is a note from Marion Parker, just to add to Mr. Parker's torment. So what does she essentially say in that little note?
Listen, remind me of the details. She was asking for her father to cooperate, you know, and the odd part of it is and maybe I hope I'm not jumping ahead here, but in the course of her being kidnapped, she and the kidnapper went to the movies, you know, so she was either very frightened or not frightened at all. It's not really clear from the evidence that's available why she was so, let's say, compliant with his request. But she definitely wrote her father and definitely asked him to cooperate.
And there's another note as well where she obviously is privy to the conversation where the kidnapper is upset and says to her father, "I saw you," or, you know, "Dad, you got to cooperate, or he'll kill me." So it seems pretty authentic in terms of.
Yeah, I believe she wrote the notes, absolutely. And in his account later, he claims to have killed her in a fit of anger, and that it was not his intention. Obviously, before she was killed, she was anxious to be released and certainly was making the plea and certainly was adding to the stress her father was feeling. I mean, he was caught between the police and the need to accommodate the kidnapper. And he was a wealthy man, so the money wasn't prohibitive or excessive. It was easily available to him, so I'm sure he wanted to just follow the instructions, get it over with, and move on.
Now, you have this heartbreaking scene in here, and all of this in the very beginning is mind-blowing, is that the police, Lucas and Raymond, actually believe, again, the prime suspect is Mr. Parker somehow.
Right.
I don't know how they justify that, rationalize that, but at the same time, at the end, he says, "Please, I can't, you know, this man's going to kill my daughter. I want to just pay the ransom," and they think, I don't think that's a good idea. And yet they still think Parker is still main suspect. So what does he do? We alluded to it in the introduction, but we have to go into detail because this is one of the most unique crimes, murders, scenarios that I've ever read. And, I mean, I've read a lot, and this is 1927. So to explain the shock of the nation, we have to talk about what the father is. He's warned by this kidnapper, but he is determined, doesn't care about the money. What happens? What is his instructions, and what does he do? Take us through that.
Well, he tells them, obviously, to come along. They meet on a street near the house, and the father is parked, and then the Hickman comes towards him and comes parallel to him, and he asks about his daughter's condition. From the father's perspective, it looks like his daughter is in the passenger seat with the car, and so they make the exchange of the money, and then Hickman pulls down the street and tells the father to wait before he comes and picks up his daughter. Is that the part you were talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so in that short interim, Hickman takes his daughter out of the car. His daughter is dead at that point. His daughter has been badly mutilated in the sense that her limbs and legs have been removed. Her eyelids have been sewn, and she's got a hat down over her forehead, so she's hard to see. And she was essentially propped up with a heavy overcoat and made to look like she was still alive. So when her father comes and discovers the condition she's in, he's obviously devastated, and goes back and tells the police that his daughter is dead. And I have to say, the police at that point were not real sympathetic, and they also kind of increased their suspicion of him at that point.
Incredible. Now, you write another, again, amazing aspect of this. Again, it's 1927. Be surprised. The next day on the front pages are photographs of the crime scene.
Yes.
And we just talked about disarticulated arms at the elbows, legs at the knees,
right.
A 12-year-old with her eyes sewn open so that he could fool her when they rode by in the car that she might still be alive, this ghoul. And these are the stories the next day. These are the photos on the front pages of the newspapers in California and further along. What do the police do now, and what's their direction
now?
Well,
yeah, listen, in those days it was common for police photographers actually to be freelance. They didn't have the kind of CSI units that we see on TV nowadays. And, the crime photographers sometimes doubled as journalist photographers, but clearly somebody from within the investigation gave the photographer access to the pictures. It's very likely that there was a bribe involved, and, it was kind of the beginning of the outrage around being sensitive, certainly to crimes against minors, being sensitive to the kinds of photographs that were released. And it kind of clearly raised the issue of what information would and should be released to the public. And in fact, that issue became more pronounced as the same pictures were actually used in newsreels. That became a significant issue nationally, actually.
When you talk about newsreels, we'll let the audience know that what these were there was two feature films, and then there was a cartoon, and then there was the newsreels, which was the news of the day. As gory as it was, this was unprecedented graphic detail, and this became controversial as well. Not everybody thought that was fit for the theaters and the family, did they?
It actually was more significant than that. Some of the theater owners refused to show them. I mean, flat out said, we're not going to show this. The studios got a little nervous about the fact that the theater owners should have that kind of power to decide what they would and wouldn't show. And the issue over whether it was appropriate went all the way to Congress and really kind of generated what then was a effort at censorship and what's called the Hayes Commission, which was a group to determine what could and couldn't be shown in theaters and to also make a kind of extensive list of what subjects were and weren't appropriate for films.
You talk about Louis B. Mayer, famous film pioneer, and at the time too, it was still no sound for film, so it was silent films.
Right.
And you also talk about just the time that it was at this time was the heroics of Charles Lindbergh flying from New York to Paris, the first telephone call from New York to London. So you talk about the times, and you also talk about how Mayer really was looking at you cite Canada. So tell us really what he looked at and what he saw this case as representing. You talk about he was a staunch anti-censorship person. So tell us what he saw in the Canadian rulings and what potential he could see from the backlash from these new newsreels and this case.
Right, yes. Listen, there's a number of issues that converged for him in particular and Hollywood in general. There was a fire in a movie theater in Canada where, I can't remember the exact number, but it was a couple of hundred kids burned to death. And there was serious concern in Canada and serious pressure to make going to the movies illegal for children. You know, that represents then and now a big percentage of the movie-going public. And also, you know, it was also the time that talking movies hadn't been out yet, but Hollywood was moving in that direction. And Mayer saw that as a potential big push in the market and a significant shift. And his real concern about the case didn't happen until after Hickman was arrested and who claimed he was insane by virtue of being addicted to movies. Well, that just sent Hollywood in a tizzy. You know, they just that was the last thing they wanted, because the debate over whether children should be allowed to see movies was in full swing, and also the issue of censorship, which was really triggered by his case, and whether or not they should show the gruesome pictures that were a part of the newsreel. I mean, for his case to have triggered that debate and for him to have claimed to have been insane by virtue of an addiction to movies was just too close to home, so to speak. So the need to really demonize the suspect in the case was a priority for Hollywood. Now, you know, it's easy to demonize him. He was obviously a person who had serious mental issues and did awful things. But the question that raises for me, and it still goes on, is it the job of the media to second-guess the outcome of a trial and really try and impose their perception of the case on the public? I think we've seen this almost unrelentlessly since then. And my personal opinion is that's not always been a good thing.
Now let's get back to the crime scene. We have the media response. We've jumped a little bit ahead, but police still don't have their suspect, Mr. Hickman, whatsoever.
Right.
So how do they possibly find out? 1927,
right.
Police work, what happens?
Well, it's interesting. There's, you know, we're all familiar with the term dragnet from the TV series. But dragnet was actually a police tactic that was invented by the L.A. Police Department. Specifically, Chief Davis came up with the idea. But a dragnet was is if you had a crime committed in a particular part of the city, you literally sent every available police officer into that part of the city to knock on every door and talk to every person who was remotely possible of committing the crime. And there was no real regard for probable cause or legal connection to the crime. They literally would interview everybody, and if anybody was even remotely suspicious, they would bring them into the police station and hold them until the person could verify their alibi until the time of the crime. So that whole process of just scooping up large numbers of people and shifting through them was called a dragnet, and they certainly initiated a very intense dragnet, obviously because of the heinousness of the crime. And in the process of doing that, they actually interviewed Hickman without realizing he was the suspect. And part of the dragnet process was to fingerprint everybody, you know, and again, with little or no probable cause. So at the time Hickman was, that he was first interviewed, he was fingerprinted. And Hickman started to panic, so he stole a car to leave the city. And it was really almost blind luck, you know. Fingerprint files now are computerized, so you kind of stick a fingerprint in the computer and you wait until it sorts the files. It's a relatively quick process. Right. But in those days, you had with fingerprint experts who could analyze what are called the whorls and swirls on a fingerprint. And there were certain general categories of whorls and swirls, and they were kind of organized based on those general categories. But within a general category, there could be 1,000 samples. And the only way you could match a fingerprint was to literally check by hand and by eyeball every fingerprint you had on record against the fingerprint you were trying to identify. So typically it was a slow and laborious process that could take days and weeks. But one of the detectives involved in the case felt that because the car was stolen near the crime scene, that there was a chance that the car that was stolen by the kidnapper, and he took a fingerprint car and relatively quickly matched it to the suspect, at which point they went back to re-interview him. He had left in another stolen car, and they found evidence of the crime at his apartment, so that identified him very quickly and early on as the primary suspect.
Now, this is part of the controversy for throughout this whole book and throughout the whole trial is the confessions. And
confessions, yes.
So right away, he starts talking. And what does he say in that first confession, and who was the first confession to?
Well, he let's back it up a little bit. He steals, at least, as I recall, two cars, I think maybe three, but he also picks up hitchhikers thinking that that would give him a cover. If he's driving alone, he'll be too obvious a suspect. So if he picks up hitchhikers, two hitchhikers call the police in Pendleton, Oregon, and say that they were given a ride by someone they thought was suspicious and someone that they thought matched the description of the suspect. And they gave the description of the car to the chief of police. So he staked out the only road through town, saw the car. The car didn't have California plates. He pulls the car over anyway. When Hickman opens the door, his gun falls out of his lap onto the ground. And he gives his first kind of semi-confession at that point by indicating that, yeah, you got me. And I mean, he definitely gave evidence of a guilty conscience. But when he goes into the police station, you know, in 1929, criminal investigation wasn't very sophisticated. And in Pendleton, Oregon, the chief of police was the chief and the only patrolman in the entire police force, and I'm sure had no experience at all with a homicide investigation. So this was all kind of new to him. He also had a very hostile environment in that the citizens of the city were ready to lynch the guy, and he was trying to appease them and also do what he thought was his duty as a police officer and a homicide detective investigator, the whole thing. So he brought a reporter in, and Hickman confesses to the reporter, which is, you know, beyond inappropriate, really absurd, and was confessed to the reporter, obviously without being read any kind of rights, even though Miranda rights were not effective on things. But you still need to guarantee even then that the confession was given in circumstances that could be used in court, which, talking to a reporter, was not that circumstance. So the reporter didn't even take notes. He wrote his impressions of the confession by memory when he got back to his office. So it was far from what I would call a definitive confession. But during that confession, Hickman tried to deflect the crime to someone else who he said pressured him into going along with it. And the confession was immediately printed in the local newspaper. So the district attorney in Los Angeles was less than pleased with how the arrest and the interrogations were handled at that point.
Now, as you write, they decide to go on to transport him, and during that transport ride, they have numerous people there, including the district attorney,
right,
and they want to get a confession from him. They're confident that he will give it to them, that he will give them details. So does he give it to them? What does he give him? What does he give authorities?
He gives actually two confessions. His first one... it's fairly straightforward. There's some indication that he was pressured with threats to give the confession, which in those days would have been normal, I have to say. And then he needed the district attorney wanted a motive, which is actually not required in a murder case, but he wanted one to kind of lock the case in. And so he made a second confession. I mean, I didn't say it specifically in the book, but the implication was the threats got more intense, and that's kind of a, if you're going to make that allegation historically, you need a little more evidence than the most available. But he certainly didn't have any defense attorney. He didn't have anybody that was advocating for him. He didn't have anybody that was advising him. And he was alone on a train, on a long train ride with three detectives, the chief of police, and the district attorney. That had to have been a bit intimidating for anybody, let alone a young man who had just committed the crime and who was clearly grappling with his own mental health issues.
And this is the time they find out, because there's only way to find out, is that they actually went to the movies together.
Exactly.
The kidnap victim, as
yes,
you mentioned.
Yes, yes.
So what did how does he explain how he got her to be able to do that, though?
Well, he claims that he was treating her nicely. He also, he had a self-perception of himself as a, being religious. He considered himself a Christian gentleman. And he, in fact, I mean, the story gets real bizarre at this point. He asked for the $1,500 because that was the amount of tuition for him to go to Bible school so he'd become a minister. So, in a sense, you could almost call the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. There was the persona of the good religious boy raised in Kansas who had good manners and good home training and wanted to act politely and proper around people. And then the vicious criminal who came unglued and committed mutilation on the body of the victim. I mean, you have a real broad dichotomy there, which actually is not that uncommon among sociopaths. Sociopaths have no real conscience, so they pretend to behave appropriately. But if something triggers them, there's no real filter in terms of expressing their emotions, and he seemed to be certainly struggling with that contradiction.
What we didn't mention, too, is that when you talk about the Christian gentleman, that's what he had said to Mr. Parker. He said, and again, what I thought was a horrifying fact was the police at that time obviously leaked details that he was not supposed to tell police. They leaked it to the media, and he, the night before, sat there for hours and hours with a supposed exchange of his daughter. And but so we, when you mention that Christian gentleman, that's the language he used. If you, you know, I want you to give you my word as a Christian gentleman. And
right,
so that was
yes.
his last, I guess, the tipping point for him was that he was humiliated and also disobeyed so blatantly by
right.
having those facts.
Yes.
He thought it certainly must have come from Parker. Not he couldn't imagine any other reason why where they would get that information.
Right, right. Yes, that, yeah, yes, yes. And that all contributed to his reaction to the case. He went through a bit of an arc himself. I don't know if you want to jump ahead on that, but he seemed to recognize that he didn't have a real strong moral filter, but he also believed that his right to do whatever he wanted was divinely ordained, and that God considered him special, and that he had the right to pretty much do whatever he wanted because he was going to do great things in the world.
Yes, well, let's get to the philosophy in a bit. What's also very fascinating, again, we got to get the motive, pardon me, the media, and also the public's reaction here. Now, while he's on this train doing this confession on the train, giving the motive in his, again, narcissistic, sociopathic mind, some rationale he's trying to convey to these, to the police chief and the district attorney and the detectives, this train stopped at every major city, you write, allowing media and the public to gaze at the vehicle of justice. Very interesting.
It was what I would consider the ground zero for the whole idea of media circus and the perp walk. I mean, they took it literally to the bus stop, and it was extreme. And it was so bad that it actually, the reaction from the public was so bad that the chief started to get nervous about the safety of his prisoner and actually set up a ruse to arrive at the main station, and but actually stop before they got there and get the suspect off the train so there wouldn't be a big crowd and any threat to his safety.
Interesting. And you write, too, that Hickman went to find a lawyer. Oh, Mrs. Hickman went to find a lawyer for her son. So
right.
who does she get? The great defender. Her very first choice was Clarence Darrow. Now, he
exactly.
said, oh, I can't do it. I can't be involved. But really, as you write, he couldn't be involved because he couldn't practice law in California. But
exactly.
Clarence Darrow did recommend somebody. So you write that he recommended this Jerome Walsh.
Right.
So tell us, again, this is the very first time that an insanity defense is used in California. You also do a little bit of the background, give that context as well. So tell us a little bit about the law just previous to that, and then this insanity defense, as novel
right.
as it might seem.
Yes, I think we need to give a little background. Darrow was truly one of the great lawyers in American
sure.
jurisprudence, and he was famous for the Scopes Monkey Trial. But he had been he had been accused of jury tampering in California and actually bribing a juror. And so he couldn't even come to California. As I remember, there was a warrant for his arrest, so he had to stay out of the state, which is kind of an interesting contradiction because he was a social reformer and a brilliant lawyer, but obviously not above corruption at some level. But he was also committed to a social movement at the time which was in favor of eliminating the death penalty. And he picked Walsh because Walsh was also against the death penalty, you know, and that raises an interesting question in terms of the viability of the council, because they both had an agenda of wanting to use the case to kind of publicize their cause,
well, sure.
Which I have to say is not always the best agenda for someone who's going to defend you in a criminal case. I mean, the lawyer has to be free to make decisions that ultimately support the situation of the client, not their own personal political views.
Well, you may be correct there, but it's done all the time for to
oh,
advance
absolutely.
That business.
But, listen, yes, absolutely, and I've seen it. And I've seen it work to the detriment of clients. You know. You know, on the other side of that, he was indigent. You know, he couldn't afford an attorney. The representation he got was ultimately competent and skilled. I just, in looking over the trial strategy, I'm not convinced that the lawyers had the best strategy that would have been possible for him at the time. And that was, in fact, criminal defense and defending people charged to homicide was my specialty as an investigator, so I've got some experience and expertise in that arena.
But to consider the time and to consider the potential jury and to consider the outrage, you talk about the outrage at
right.
that time,
yes.
this 12-year-old girl dismembered,
yes.
mutilated,
absolutely.
Left in a bag.
Yeah.
You know, so... And everything is political. I mean,
right.
the DA's,
yes.
everything he says, every press release is politically motivated and calculated to a certain degree. So what do they do with, in terms of this insanity defense, you say you don't agree on their strategy. But you talk about the Macnaughton rule, not everybody knows that, but that clear
yes.
definition of insanity in terms of distinction, knowing right from wrong. So it's a pretty hard hurdle to overcome that somehow
it
you
is.
Could prove, the onus is on you, the defense, to prove you didn't know right from wrong at the time of that crime. So how
right.
do they proceed with this didn't
well,
know
yeah,
right from wrong? What is their
right.
course?
Yeah, let me back that up just a little bit. The Macnaughton rule originally was established in law in England, and England has a different system than we do. In England, there's very few statutory laws. The laws are based on what's called case laws, or the ruling of judges from the bench. Does that make sense? I hope I explained that clearly. So that the Macnaughton rule was a case involving someone who attempted a political assassination, and the judge determined that he was insane, didn't know the difference between right and wrong, and therefore not capable of forming intention. Okay?
Right.
In the United States, you can't be charged with any crime that's not written down as a statute and something illegal. So the crime of murder is actually a homicide with intention, and then there can be different forms of intention. So, and there's actually some variation from state to state on what constitutes a homicide and what the level of intention is. But just before Hickman was arrested, the state legislature had passed a new law defining how the Macnaughton rule could be used in a murder case. So if you go to most criminal trials, the prosecutor presents the case, and then the defense tries to rebut it. Based on the legislation in California at the time, the only way, can you still hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. The only way you could plead insanity is if you first gave a full confession to the crime. And that instead of having the prosecutor present the case first, the defense presented their case for insanity first, which is complete reversal of the normal criminal process. And in those days, there wasn't a big budget for preparing the defense. You know, he required expert testimony and psychiatrists and so on. As I recall, I think they had 30 days to prepare. He had one or two interviews with a minimal number of doctors. And I just think, at the very least, the defense attorneys could have asked for a delay and more time for preparation and put the issue of insanity into a broader context. But the thing that you couldn't do, and the precedent that was set, and which is still true, you can't have a normal homicide trial where you plead innocent, then you get convicted, and then at that point in the proceedings you decide you're insane. You have to go into the trial with that defense and that point of view, and then the judge has to make a determination if there's sufficient evidence for an insanity plea to allow that to proceed. And I have to say, the judge who did rule on it was very articulate and very thorough, and in fact established the precedent for that process to this day.
Now, you also talk about, which complicates this story as well, is that this narcissistic sociopath here in prison writes a letter intended for his friend, but the guards find it beforehand. I don't want you to get the exact words that he says, but what's basically the gist of what he has said in that letter to his friend?
Well, it was actually the second time he approached the subject. He was looking for reasons. He was looking for behavior that would indicate insanity. And in fact, he had asked, I believe, the reporter when he was initially arrested the same question, and that he had kind of a – he was obviously looking for reasons to fit in that category that apparently he was trying to fake. I mean, that's the logical surmise from those kinds of questions.
Now, you talked about what was interesting, we haven't mentioned this either, but we alluded to it, was that there's a Dr. Wagner, and he is the person that, if we go back, had to look at the body of this child and tell us what the coincidence is before we talk about the other friendship he has with Asia Keys.
Yes, the doctor was Parker's neighbor. He knew the victim. He knew the victim's daughter. He'd watched them grow up. And also, as I recall, his initial autopsy, they only had portions of the body and the disarticulated limbs were delivered the next day and wrapped in newspapers. So in addition to it being a gruesome autopsy, one that was probably unprecedented for him, in the sense that that was an uncommon crime and he probably never had a similar autopsy, to actually do an autopsy on someone you know, that wouldn't be allowed nowadays, and I'm sure it was extremely, to his credit, I mean, he was able to do it. I'm sure it was extremely upsetting, and he said as much, you know. So, but, you know, if you're going to present your testimony in court and it comes out that you knew the victim, that would just be hugely prejudicial towards the jury. So, you know, that would just, it was one of many precedents that was set in that case.
Now let's talk about a little bit about the main character here, and this is this Hickman. Hickman makes numerous statements, but the one he makes a statement to the jury about his great providence all his life, and this statement is read out. Tell us about his self-importance and his idea of providence.
Yeah, providence was his language for, I would describe it as, for it was his language for his description of his belief that he had been touched by God, that he had been chosen by God for a special destiny, and that the support of what he called divine providence lifted him above the normal rules of society and morality, and gave him a blanket permission to do whatever he needed to do to get what it was he wanted in any particular moment.
You also write about at the time that to explain extreme criminal behavior, it was considered to be the result of the influence of the devil. And
right.
So then when we look at the psychiatrist at the time, they had a term, a psychiatric term, dementia praecox.
Right.
And this is the forerunner of schizophrenia. So
Right. What,
I mean, even though they don't have much of a budget, he still got a couple psychiatrists to diagnose him and
Right. To
say that he has a disease that would render him insane, doesn't he?
Right. Yes, listen, that's actually a disease, even though it's no longer recognized. I've studied it a bit. The disease, it's essentially a Latin term referring to the fact that the patient believes that they're possessed by something or someone, either spirits or a god or whatever. But, you know, the thing that's interesting is that the definitive study of that phenomena and the psychiatrists who defined the conditions of that phenomena was Carl Jung, who was one of the founders of psychiatry.
Right.
And he actually, when he initially wrote, it was his doctoral thesis, was to define the symptoms of dementia praecox. And in his doctoral thesis, he lists, I think, about 30 symptoms. 20 of those he can explain psychologically and as causing mental illness. But about 10 of them he leaves unanswered, unresolved, kind of opening the door to the fact that some forms of altered consciousness can actually transcend the consciousness of the patient. Now, that's not to justify the behavior, to say that he was in fact touched by God, but even at that time, the diagnosis itself was not particularly definitive, not particularly widespread, and certainly not accepted by all psychiatrists who would be called on to testify.
Now, you also write and you juxtapose these separate parts in terms of having the fledgling Hollywood want to counter, again, this story is not going away. You mentioned
right.
in newsreels, some states won't run these newsreels. And then there's also
right.
talk, because you mentioned in Canada, where the Roman Catholic Church gets involved and
right,
starts calling.
Right.
And it seems, so tell us what basically they say about films, which, again, really just seems obvious, ominously, like not so long ago in America.
Right. Well, you know, it was actually the beginning of a debate that I'm not really sure has been resolved, and I have to say that personally I have mixed feelings on it. There was a concern of the influence of films on the development of young minds. I think a case can be made that that might be true, you know. But you have to juxtapose that against the right of freedom of expression, and then you, of course, have to juxtapose that again against parental guidance and who's monitoring what their kids are doing and what they're watching. I really think that was the beginning dialogue in the conversation that's led up to some of the questioning about whether or not violent video games has influenced some of the mass killings we've seen in the last 20 years or so. And I have to say, from my experience, again, with murder cases, it seems to me that that influence could be there, hasn't been fully studied, certainly wasn't understood, and at the time literally terrified Hollywood in the thought that certain films would have a negative influence on childhood development, was seen as a serious threat to the industry.
Now, back at the court case, you talk about the media being interested and the public being interested, so this courthouse is full. And so there's more than enough people very, very interested in this. What is the demeanor of the defendant at this trial?
You know, he seemed more or less kind of oblivious. I don't want to say amused, but bemused, if you know the difference. I mean, he was trying. I believe that he was trying to project a persona of being above it all, and that he probably had kind of made his peace with the fact that he was going to be convicted and executed. And I think he made a clear shift from trying to justify what he did, to try and blame the father and to blame his circumstances, to trying to make the case that the thing that divine providence had chosen for him to do was to be kind of a role model for what not to do and how not to behave if you were a young man growing up at the time. I mean, he kind of made some effort to transform what he did into something noble, which, you know, is kind of hard to identify with or accept. But the thing that was ironic about that is he was actually praised for what he did by Ayn Rand, who wrote the book Atlas Shrugged, which was kind of, again, a precursor for a lot of the self-help books and the kind of the self-help seminars and the whole life coach movement of, you know, taking charge of your life. Ayn Rand thought that he was the first example of what she called the fully developed evolving male. I actually think she called it Superman. But she spoke of people acting on their own impulse and that being a noble thing. So she held press conferences where she praised Hickman and offered her support and felt that he had was someone to emulate, not someone to condemn. And it actually caused a controversy within her own movement, and I think it lost her some following. But the fact that people were even entertaining that idea at the time, kind of, it was one of many kind of ground zero discussions that emerged around the case that, you know, to a certain extent remain unresolved. I don't think anybody would argue that he's a great person, but certainly the notion that self-interest is to be elevated and explored is still commonly accepted in certain expressions of self-help literature.
I was totally shocked. Not that I'm an expert on Ayn Rand, but I couldn't see why she would have see any justification or any admiration for this guy at all, and it hurt her movement. I could understand that because I can't see the rationalization for it. Now, what was interesting, too, is that, again, like you say, there's so many issues involved with this. It's like a confluence of events occurs, and this case represents so much groundbreaking precedent in here as well, in terms of they talked about the insanity at that time, and they called it delusional insanity. And the lawyers tried to argue that he inherited it from his grandmother, who had been institutionalized for 15 years earlier. And they also cited, because at that time they didn't know anything about epilepsy, so they said, well, his first cousin is epileptic. So there was a couple cases of epilepsy.
Right.
His grandmother was insane. So somehow they tried every angle at this insanity, that he was delusional from the movies, but also from genetically. he was insane, right, or predisposed to insanity, didn't they argue?
Right. I think, you know, for me, having dealt with some of those cases, you can know the difference between right and wrong and still be delusional and mentally ill. And I think it remains an unresolved question of whether or not we're going to treat mental illness in criminal cases, which is clearly manifest but does not meet the standard of the McNaughton rule. I think that's an issue that we haven't really fully come to terms with as a society.
Mm-hmm. Now, with go ahead.
I was just going to say, and that doesn't mitigate either way for or against the death penalty, but there's certainly, I've dealt with cases where I knew my client was not dealing with a full deck and not dealing with reality, and yet understood that they had done something wrong. That becomes a hard kind of case to negotiate, hard to know how to proceed with it, and you know, your choices of insanity plea are so limited that that doesn't really become an option. So I think it's a topic that warrants further discussion, for sure. And I'd also say that along with that, when people exhibit what I would call odd or abhorrent or deviant behavior, it becomes such a hot ticket for the media that I'm not sure that what I call becoming a celebrity criminal speaks well for the possibility of creating justice for the defendant either. I think that becomes increasingly difficult, especially as media becomes more easily available, more widespread, more instantaneous, and more opinionated, you know. It's another topic that this case kind of was ground zero for that I don't think has been fully resolved.
Well, you know, we don't have the debate raging, I think,
no,
in terms of insanity.
No, that's
but
that's
you see,
true.
You see more,
yeah,
and more of these cases like you talk about, and we'll mention it again because it's interesting. You talk at the end of this case, and we'll talk about it, James Egan Holmes, July 20th, 2012. And why you mentioned that, tell us why you mentioned the Holmes case, July 20th, 2012.
Oh, remind me. What was that about?
Well, he killed 12 people at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado during
a
midnight screening of Batman.
Yes, yes. Boy, that really gets to the heart of my perspective on the thing. I think Holmes was clearly insane. I think he knew the difference between right and wrong. And at the risk of sounding a little conspiratorial, there's some indication that he may have had some pressure and help and some people that were pushing him in the direction of being violent. And I'm not really sure that we have the legal perspective to pursue that to the extent that it needs to be looked at and addressed.
What's interesting is that, and this is by coincidence, sheer coincidence, that January 4th, Joyce and Stephen Singular, he's written a book called The Spiral Notebook, and it includes the story of James Holmes. So we'll get
yes,
a little more,
listen,
as he's a fine investigative journalist, so we'll get the story
right,
at least
I
don't know anything of the story. So,
well, listen, I don't want to go off too far on a tangent, but my mentor as an investigator was Bill Turner, who I worked with him. He was the lead investigator for Jim Garrison on the Clay Shaw trial on the Kennedy assassination, and then defended Sirhand and Arthur Bermer and James Earl Ray. There's elements of all those cases that have not come fully to light that I think a broader perspective on insanity would bring to light. You know, for Sirhan, we used hypnosis because Sirhan had no memory of what happened that day. I mean, he still doesn't. And he convincingly doesn't have any memory. And every time an expert psychiatrist was brought in to hypnotize him, rather than remember what happened, he went into a deeper trance. That's an extremely sophisticated form of hypnosis that probably involved narco-hypnosis. And so the whole issue of the ability to manipulate people or create Manchurian candidates or to exploit insanity, I think we're barely scratching the surface on understanding that whole topic.
Well, I mean, I can't argue with that because those are extraordinary cases. But when you
they are
again, I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent because
no, I don't either.
Another,
I'm not implying that was the case with Hickman, but he certainly initiated the conversation. Absolutely.
Well, certainly, and the thing is, I agree with you that the conversation has to be ongoing because we're seeing. You know, there's always forces at play. You always see this psychiatric industry, we'll say, or the industry
right.
itself is pushing to include more people to have disorders. So it's
right.
a creeping sort of mental illness, and then that, of course, then you use those, many attorneys successfully use for mitigating circumstances to say, well, this was the horrible background that my client had. But Canada is taken to another level because we do not adhere to the right and wrong version
right,
of insanity.
Right.
You know, so I did a story where Dr. Turcotte received 6 months in a institution after killing his two children. Now he's just been convicted again after the outrage of a certain segment of the population, and his
right.
wife, being a doctor herself. He was convicted of second-degree murder with exactly the same evidence. But 6 months insanity, and the premise was that he was depressed. So you can see that this is what, I don't think Americans know of that case unless they listen to this program, but I
right.
think there is that fear. Americans fear that that somebody would be put into an institution and then
right.
released someday. Whereas
right.
in Canada, we have that as it's not the exception to the rule, it is the rule. They will be
right.
released. And as we see,
right.
the Greyhound cannibal killer in 6 years released on the streets
right.
in
right.
Canada. So
right.
I think that because as you say, how can you discern who is mentally ill
exactly.
if you say, well,
yeah.
right and wrong is just not enough?
Well, listen, I think here's my perspective on it. You raised some really good points, and I appreciate the dialogue on this issue because it's getting to the heart of the matter. There's been, in my lifetime, there's been a huge increase in what I would call, they're called spree killings, where people just randomly start shooting people. I mean, it happens all the time, you know. In the last few years, we've attributed that some of it to terrorism and political acts of violence. But there's still a long list of people that just wake up one day and decide to start killing people. You understand? Now, that's... Take the issue of insanity off the table for a minute. Take the issue of how to proceed with the court case off the table. We still need to understand why that's happening. And we need to understand why it's happening nowadays. We need to understand why it's happening, particularly in America, where there's many countries that just it's a non-existent issue, you know. And we need to understand what are the forces that come to play that would trigger that kind of response. I mean, if it was an isolated incident, understanding it, maybe we'll never know. But for it to be so painfully common, I think really raises the bar in terms of the importance of the issue. And, you know, that's certainly, you know, as an author, I don't like to hammer the message on people's heads, but that's certainly one of the concerns I had in writing the book. And it's certainly my hope that those issues will be looked at more astutely than they have been.
Well, I certainly agree with you that the new move towards these, I don't know, it's not one-off, but the incredible amount of fame these killers want to gain instantly.
Right.
They don't want to wait. They don't want to do 20 years and then come forward and say, I killed 50 people.
Right.
They have to make a big splash, so they're killing people in big numbers increasingly big numbers. And so, and then shock value. So
right.
It is a, I think it is a confluence of things going on there. And again, you're right. There is, it may not be that you ban video games, but to say that violent video games have no influence on anyone is absurd.
I agree.
Everybody's idea of fame, and even if a person is a, we'll say, a, who's a loser, but they may believe they're a loser. Well, this is the way to get beyond that, because any kind of fame is fame these days. So there's another bunch of phenomena almost going on at the same time to not really well explain, but to somewhat explain this new phenomena of why people would resort to this in these big numbers, it looks like.
And you have the seeds of all of that, interestingly enough, in this particular case. You know, you have the seeds of the question of insanity and what does that look like. You have the discussion of what causes insanity. You have the discussion of what kind of insanity legitimately mitigates a sentence. And then I think more importantly, and this is something that I think is rarely discussed, you have the whole issue of the birth of what I would call the celebrity criminal. And you have the birth of the paparazzi covering the celebrity criminal more from a entertainment perspective than a real effort to understand jurisprudence. And I think those are things that started back then that have gone unchecked, that are not serving our culture well. Let me put it like that. And that a more deliberated and conscious discussion of those issues, I think, is important. It also, you know, you also have the issue of what I call talking heads, or the self-styled experts. You know, you have a situation where there's a lot of news shows where guilt and innocence is declared before the trial even starts. I mean, personally, I find that to be inappropriate. And I think the quickness of the news cycle, the need for celebrities, and the whole issue of paparazzi, I mean, we can look, the trend towards that led to the whole failure of the media to predict the outcome of the last presidential election. I mean, the whole issue goes way beyond criminal justice and law and order and insanity. I think it's a tendency that threatens our perception of reality in some ways.
You also have the issue of the media treatment. We haven't mentioned too much, but this poor Mr. Parker and his wife and family. I mean, he not only was a suspect, but also the treatment in the media, just the treatment period, it was like the media could care less. There was no sympathy for the Parker family.
None at all. And I'm not sure that that's improved all that much since then. But I think more significantly, for me anyway, was the fact that Myers hired Edgar Rice Burroughs, the creator of Tarzan, to function as a reporter during the trial, and Burroughs slammed the guy. I mean, there was nothing journalistic at all about his approach to the trial. That's not to say he wasn't a good writer or that Tarzan isn't a great story, but he was hired to do a hatchet job, and that's what he did, you know. And I'm not defending Hickman by any stretch of the imagination, but I think there's a certain amount of fairness of the treatment of suspects that we should expect, if nothing else, to keep from tainting the jury pool. I mean, my goodness, you know, if he's convicted before you select a jury, the chances of a fair trial fade rather quickly, I think.
We haven't mentioned this, but I imagine people might guess, but we might as well state, because this is an important part of the trial as well. This insanity defense, he had a vigorous defense. He had two good attorneys. They did good closing arguments. Asa Keys, as you write, though, got famous from this, but mm-hmm. that isn't the end of his story. And he was mm-hmm. a friend of Parker as well. It took,
right.
you say, just 45 minutes. What was the verdict?
Well, the verdict was guilty, and he pleaded guilty. The verdict was to execute him. He died by hanging. The thing that there's not real strong evidence of, but it really it appeared that Myers may have made inappropriate financial contributions to Keys during the trial. It's also clear that Keys did a lot to cover up major crimes among the Hollywood elite at the time, and that he was actually convicted for taking bribes in one of the first Ponzi schemes in California. And the irony is that he served time at San Quentin, which is the place where Hickman was executed.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. A 14-year sentence, too, so...
Yes, and you know, when he came out, he was given a job in Hollywood as a script consultant on movies that involved legal issues, which is really a non-existent job. That was further payoff for whatever he contributed to the media perception of that whole trial. But I want to say, too, maybe we're coming... The thing that really struck me is that Hickman's psychiatrist, the one that the defense attorneys hired, really sabotaged the case. I mean, totally. Remember when Clinton was asked about his affair with Monica Lewinsky and he answered by saying, "What? It depends on the meaning of what is. Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, the same thing in the Hickman trial. The doctor said, are you sure of your diagnosis? And the doctor said, I can't really be sure of anything. It's like, what? You know, it was like, I don't want to accuse him of anything, but I have to say going there was very suspicious, unprecedented, and gave the jury all the opening they needed to... convict him without qualification. You know?
Was there any supporters of the idea that he was insane? And at that time, was there many supporters that he should not be put to death?
You know, I think that that issue broke down around the question of the morality of the death penalty and not the question of his guilt or innocence. It was certainly hard to, except for Ayn Rand, it was certainly hard to generate any kind of sympathy or support for what he did, especially the heinousness of the crime itself. He didn't help himself by talking too much, and appeal to divine justification, I'm sure, offended a lot of people for religious reasons. So if the intention of the lawyers was to use it as a test case for ending the death penalty, it wasn't the best choice on that part.
No. Now, you say that this took quite a bit of your life, this book. How long were you involved with this case?
Well, you know, let me tell you this. 2 weeks ago, I turned 70. I wrote my first book when I was 19. I've self-published about a dozen books. And, you know, 50 years after writing my first book, I got picked up by a major publisher. So in the literary world, they call that an overnight success.
Wow.
But, you know, I spent a couple of years working on the book. Once I got started in it, I recruited my brother again to help me with the research. We had to kind of petitioned a lot of files from Sacramento where they were in archives, and kind of sort through it. And I have to say, my editor did a really good job. I think my initial draft, I may have put too much emphasis on Hollywood and the history of Hollywood, which was not really as germane to the story as I initially thought. So, there was some sorting out and rethinking. But, the thing that's exciting for me is I've got another book already finished. It's kind of a follow-up. Remember, did you see the movie Gangster Squad?
Yes.
My father was a member of Gangster Squad. And,
wow.
He made a deathbed confession, which I believe is the true story. I think the Hollywood movie was kind of a cartoon, and I feel a commitment to him to write the true story. He was really a good man. He had good intentions, and he got some caught up into some stuff that was kind of epic in its tragic consequences. But, I think there are historical moments that we can learn from. I think this was one of them. I think his story is another example of that. I'm looking forward to kind of moving forward in a similar line.
Do you have a tentative title for that?
Yes, it's called Almost a Perfect Murder. It's about the Samuel Rumel, who was Mickey Cohen's attorney, was murdered in front of his house. It's an unsolved murder in Los Angeles, and based on things my father told me, I'm able to solve the murder. Absolutely. And excuse me?
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just saying, and again, it had huge implications for the whole issue of dealing with corruption in law enforcement, dealing with organized crime. At the time they set up the task force, the media consensus and the FBI consensus was that organized crime did not exist on a national level. And my father, who was involved in wiretapping members of the mob, certainly knew that it was a real phenomenon. There was real bad things going on. There was real corruption within the police department. There was real violence that was going unchecked as a result of the corruption. And there was an effort to kind of deal with those things in a noble way that got sidetracked, let's say. And, to me, that's a very compelling story.
What was interesting, I guess, and just spookily too, is the this was 6 days before Christmas that this murder happened, and we're talking.
We're talking about tonight, aren't we? I don't know. It's close. Yeah. Or we may have passed the day. Yeah, but yeah, that
well,
is
5 days.
So it's Jung called that synchronicity, a significant coincidence. That's certainly that, and. Believe me, I'm really, really grateful for the opportunity to talk about it. I'm excited, but there's some nibbles at making it a movie, so I'm kind of hopeful about that too. That would be wonderful. It's on my bucket list. I'm actually surprised at to what extent the story has struck a nerve with a lot of people. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback. I thought it would be kind of a niche book with a few people would be interested in it because that's what they were into. But I have to say at this point, the interest has moved beyond that niche market to people that kind of get the social overtones that I was trying to raise in telling the story.
You have a very interesting killer, though, too. He really is
True.
Ahead of his time in combining
True.
A lot of the things, the narcissism that we see, that we think is very modern, we really see there the idea of the movies, and not the idea that he used the excuse of the movies. He actually,
right.
He was an armed robber just so he could go to the movies every day for $3.25, like you say.
Exactly, and I think anything that encourages critical self-evaluation, both individually looking at our own lives and also how we relate to each other and how we process problems as a community. I mean, anything that supports that is a worthy endeavor. And that was certainly, if I may say so, my intention was to stimulate some dialogue on those issues, because I think if they remain unconscious, that we run the risk of not having the higher aspirations of our culture went out in the end, if that makes sense.
Now, certainly this book is important, like I say, because it just seems to be a harbinger of things to come, all wrapped up in this one case. And as you say, as you say with Mr. Holmes coming up, and this case that happened in 2012 that's still in the public eye, is an indication
right.
that these issues that were there in 1927 are still today evident in 2017.
Sure. And you have the issue of, and I can't remember, the fellow that shot Ronald Reagan wanting to impress Jodie Foster, or was that the guy that shot John Lennon? I don't remember now. But, you know, it's not a theme that hasn't reoccurred since then, you know? And it was, people identifying with the movie figures as a justification for crimes, I've seen that more than once in my career. And
it's a completely disturbing trend what we have. I mean, and not that serial
right.
killers wasn't a bad enough trend. This new
right.
trend is even more disturbing in that how many people you can't see it coming. It's impossible
no.
to see it coming. And then we are
right.
talking about the issues of, I mean, I think there you personally could be a psychopath and be insane as well and be paranoid
right.
schizophrenic as well. And I think that's what we're getting. We're getting a combination of things that we haven't seen before.
And as a society, we could come to the conclusion that despite those mental illnesses, we want to punish people as a criminal. We can make that judgment. But I think it needs to be an informed judgment and not an unconscious judgment and not a judgment that uses any political, social, or economic reason for not fully examining the forces that are at play.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
And
I want to thank you
yes.
very much, David, for coming on and talking about Not Just Evil. And we look forward to having you on in the near future with Almost the Perfect Murder. For those that might want to contact you, do you do Facebook? Do you have a Facebook page, website?
You know, I do. I have a Facebook page under Dave Wilson, DaveWilson, on Facebook. You can friend me there. We can talk about these issues at more length. I'd really enjoy doing that. In fact, I've started kind of a blog on that Facebook page where I trace the history of the justice system in America and some of the issues that have evolved, like racism, sexism, and homophobia. I mean, there's a whole history and arc of how we've approached those issues legally, and I think it's worthy of studying and examination because it's really informative in some of the reasons for some of the laws that we still grapple with are less than noble, so I think that's worth examining as well.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, David. You have a great evening and a great holiday season, and hope
Listen,
to talk to
I
you
wanna,
again.
And I really, really want to thank you. It was a great interview. You asked the right questions, the good questions. It was a great dialogue, and I was blessed by the invitation. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Have a great evening. Thank you.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
For those True Murder fans, I want to thank you. We're wrapping up the year of 2016, and I just wanted to give you my heartfelt thank you to all the people that listen to these programs, who have listened to these programs and been a supporter, contacting me with compliments and messages of support. I really, really do appreciate it. And stay tuned for more True Murder in the new year. January is going to knock your socks off. We have Stephen Singular, The Spiral Notebook about James Holmes, as we mentioned. Catherine Casey with her book Possessed. Harold Schechter, incredible, don't miss this, Depraved about H.H. Holmes. And then The Politics of Murder with Margot Nash. And that's January. And just next year, a blockbuster year of more fantastic authors talking about their incredible books. And I also wanted to mention, thanks to the incredible True Murder fans, over 42 million downloads so far of the program, and we're well over 4 million listeners per month. So I want to thank you very much. Have yourself a great holidays. I'll see you back in January. Good night.